professor of philosophy at Yeshiva University, editor of the Torah Ramada Journal, Dr. David Schatz.
I've been asked to say something specifically about the world of thought that was bequeathed to us by Rabbi Wurzburger, Aleph HaShalom, the chetza of Jewish thought that he left us, as distinct perhaps from the gavra, the individual. And yet I am mindful that in the case of some people, their thought and their life, what they say and who they are so bound up together as to permit no easy separation of one from the other. In the Yerushalmi and Shkolim, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, "Ein osin nefashos letzadikim divrehem heim heim zichronam," that you don't construct monuments for the righteous, he says, but rather their words serve as their memory. Now the halachic authorities attempt to reconcile Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel's statement with the practice of erecting matzevos, monuments, often large ones, even to renowned individuals. But I want to bypass that and just look at the idiom itself, divrehem heim heim zichronam. I think it can mean more than one thing. On one level, what it means to say that their words are their monument is that, and what Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel no doubt meant, is that people who leave us with a large written legacy already gained lasting recognition and notice through those works, and they don't need elaborate memorials to be remembered. They already have a measure of fame, and their name is known. And that's one meaning of the phrase. The other meaning that occurred to me is this, that the words could mean, divrehem heim heim zichronam, that sometimes people's words are a fitting memorial to who they are. That sometimes their words are a window into the person, and that what they left us in a literary form is a profound expression of their inner selves. If sometimes you can read a person like a book, in other cases you can read a book as if you were reading a person. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, explaining the concept of Elu ve'elo divrei Elokim Chayim, explained that all of a person's kochos ha-nefesh, all of a person's characteristics and powers of the soul, go into what they produce in the world of Torah. And while sometimes those kochos are hidden from our vision, sometimes they are manifest to all, even through layers of abstract and complex thought. Rabbi Walter Wurzburger, Aleph HaShalom, was in the latter category. The gavra shone through in the chetza that he left us. And I welcome this opportunity to memorialize a man whom I knew as a senior colleague and as a friend. Some of what I say will overlap with some of what you've heard already. That reminds me of the time I was teaching Plato's Republic to a class, and a student came up to me afterwards and said, "Is it okay to use the monarch notes on Plato, this digest of notes?" And I said, "Well, I don't know, I haven't seen it, I can't vouch for it." He said, "Well, I've used it, and he says a lot of the same things that you say." I took this, of course, as an accusation, and I said to the student, "Can you think of a reason for that?" And he said, "No," and I explained to him, "Well, it's because we read the same book." We read the same book, we read the same person. What did Walter Wurzburger expound as a thinker? Well, his philosophy stands out as what's called a dialectical one. In other words, as a true disciple of the Rav, he stressed the fact that Judaism does not absolutize values, that it demands of us a dialectic or an oscillation between competing valid values, between freedom and submission, between Ahavas Hashem and Yiras Hashem, between body and soul, between the universal and the particular, between the hope for redemption and recognition of the unredeemed nature of the world in which we live. All of those have a place. And one of the finest and most succinct statement of his view is an essay entitled "Integrating Opposing Values into the Service of God." The message of a dialectical outlook is a call for balance, for integrating opposites, and for an aversion to extremism, is because no sooner do you give expression to one value than you feel impelled to express its opposite as well, as a counterweight. and so you don't wind up embracing extremes. Thus, Rabbi Walter Wurzburger was well known on the one hand for maintaining that in halacha there is room for autonomy, and yet no less often did he stress the need to at times submit to a norm that we cannot justify. And he saw self-surrender not as a way in which a person becomes alienated, but on the contrary, in which the way in which a person often can achieve self-expression and experiences of her own worth and dignity. That was him. Never an extremist or an absolutist. The middle path. How did this translate into his conduct, into his interaction with people? Well, I would say that he bequeathed to us a certain ethos of controversy. Opposites are the very stuff of debate, and they are the very stuff of debate in Torah, in matters of halacha and in matters of hashkafa. Chazal knew this, and they valued machlokas, but they also knew very well the dangers of a culture of debate. They knew very well that what begins as an intellectual controversy sometimes degenerates into personal animosity and vilification. And for this reason, they stress that combatants in the world of Torah, no matter how fiercely they may argue with each other, always have to end up, ohavim zeh, they have to end up with love of each other. Indeed, people who studied with years with the same chavrusa will know that 90% of the time with that chavrusa was spent arguing. And yet there's a bond of friendship that's formed through it. And they illustrated this, Chazal did, through the example of Rabbi Yochanan, who was inconsolable over the loss of Resh Lakish, because Resh Lakish was his biggest critic. And he said, my own understanding is now shriveled and it's hampered by the fact that Resh Lakish is no longer here. Rabbi Walter Wurzburger loved ideas, but he didn't love only his own ideas. He even loved objections to his view. He loved other voices, and he loved the joust. Rabbi Wurzburger's books were reviewed. He felt, and said to me many times, that a serious, questioning review that took issue with him meant much more to him than sweetheart reviews that were full of routine compliments and that he reflected no real engagement with his thought and with ideas. That is also part of his genuineness and part of his allergy to phoniness. He conducted intellectual debate with grace and with appreciation and with a modesty that sometimes shaded over into an almost self-effacing quality. One can apply the words that were used to describe Beis Hillel, Nochin va'aluvin hayu. He was a person who was easygoing. He was patient and forbearing in the face of criticism, as Shalom spoke about so well. A phrase that you will find in his work, like a scarlet thread, is after having expressed his own position, he will say, this is not to deny that. And then he would give very respectful ground to the very side that he had been laboring against. He never robbed his opponents of cogency where he thought that they possessed it. And his thought reflected, therefore, the best of both worlds, his own and that of his critics. His last contribution to a tradition symposium was in 1998, when rather than simply reaffirm his commitment to valuing the secular world, a commitment which he held all his life, he acknowledged disillusionment with modern culture, the utter permissiveness, the family disintegration, the crime, and yet he felt that he could build upon all that and still continue to affirm our need to involve ourselves in the world and to address all facets of human existence. He also had the good fortune of, in the supposer, he always had the last word because he was near the end of the alphabet, except when Michael Wichegrad was the participant. That was Rabbi Wurzburger, never deaf to what others were saying. Machshava, and his work had a kind of cutting-edge quality to it. In fact, it occurred to me it's sort of awkward to speak about Rabbi Walter Wurzburger in his heyday, because in a sense he didn't have a heyday. His whole career was his heyday, and he remained vibrant and prolific and adaptive and au courant until the very end, even when his heart was failing him. If he were a person with more gaiva, it might have thrust him into the public eye still more, and he might have been appreciated all the more. But that wasn't who he was. At the same time, he was far from wishy-washy. He was absolutely clear about what could not be given up. He had what nowadays we speak of moral clarity. He had moral clarity and he had theological clarity. He was firm about essentials of Emuna, and the passion and eloquence with which he defended Orthodoxy's beliefs earned him the great respect of non-Orthodox and even non-Jewish thinkers. He gave them what to admire in us. And furthermore, he bequeathed the whole vocabulary to people who deal in the realm of Machshava. Terms like covenantal imperatives and metahalachic propositions and Jewish virtue ethics. Because what he fought against was some of the negative stereotypes of halacha. That halacha is an arid legalism, that it is irrelevant to burning issues of the day, that it left no room for the cultivation of morality and conscience. The very first words of his book, Ethics of Responsibility, tell us that it is generally assumed that traditional Judaism constitutes a purely legalistic religion. And he says, I hope to dispel this misconception and demonstrate that Jewish piety involves more than meticulous adherence to the various rules and norms of religious law. It also demands the cultivation of an ethical personality. It is not merely the way of God, it is, he says, a way to God. We are commanded to engage in a never-ending quest for moral perfection, which transcends the requirements of an ethics of obedience. Or, as he quotes the Rav in the book, as saying, halacha is a floor, not a ceiling. In 1962, I believe it was, Dr. Wurzburger succeeded Dr. Lamb as editor of Tradition. And I think that the way he presided over Tradition is a sterling example of his ever-percolating mind and his openness. As editor, he shaped the direction, the thought, and the forms of Orthodoxy for, I believe, a quarter of a century. The focus of Orthodoxy for a quarter of a century. We remember most immediately from those years the fact that it was under his editorship that the Rav Zatzal published Lonely Man of Faith and Confrontation and later Five Essays in 1978. But the hallmark of his editorship beyond that was first of all the range of topics. Take a look at issues from the 70s, look at the great quality and number of articles that appear in every issue. Secondly, look at the diversity of positions on the Orthodox spectrum that the contributions represented. And third, look at something else, and that's what I would describe as the closing of generation gaps. He took on to his board, or as his regular contributors, young people. Shalom Carmi, Hillel Goldberg, Joel Walowelski, all of them 30 years his junior. He never flaunted his seniority or his experience. He had a total lack of self-importance, always treated people with respect, collegiality, and mutuality. We today are all the beneficiaries of his very careful cultivation then of young people. And look, in fact, who is eulogizing him today. People not only from the next generation after him, but you'll soon hear from one in the generation after that. I would be remiss if I did not close with what he left us with at YU in particular. He understood full well the problems that are posed by secularization, of leaving to human hands that which once had been assigned to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, control over illness, over the economy, over the government, and the like. But as a disciple of the Rav, he knew that the existence of a Jew is not only that of humble, retreating submission. He knew not only about Adam II in the Rav's Lonely Man of Faith, but also about the aggressive and modern-minded Adam I. Judaism does not negate the world, he insisted. It hallows it through human participation in it. Rabbi Wurzburger contributed immensely to that partnership between Kadosh Baruch Hu and humanity. And as he wrote in that final symposium contribution, not his final essay of all, but the final symposium contribution, I was taught by my illustrious teacher and mentor, Rav Yosef Vizalarechik Zatzal, that we do not look upon this world as a veil of tears from which we seek to escape by flight into transcendental realms. Halacha mandates that we endow our existence in the here and now with transcendental significance. We are enjoined not to suppress, but to sanctify our various natural inclinations and drives. It is our task to employ our creative capacities toward harnessing the forces of nature for the benefit of humanity. As I read those words, I can think how he must have seen his own work in Machshava as a form of Avodas Hashem. And so to conclude, Divrehem Heim Heim Zichronam, let the words of this penetrating thinker serve not only to keep his name alive, adding to his renown as a thinker, but let them serve to keep him alive, as we recall through his own words, his fondness, with fondness, with love, and with admiration, and with the desire to emulate. Let us recall all that he embodied in his intellectual exchanges: sincerity, collegiality, sweetness, integrity, balance, and civility. This was a Rav and a Mensch, a pleasure to know, a pleasure to be with. And just as he bridged gaps between generations, may the memory of both the man and his work be a source of blessing for generations to come. Yehi Zichro Baruch.